Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today has loved weather since he was in the third grade. When he became an elementary school teacher, his classes ran a school weather station. Mike Graff got a consulting job with the Weather Channel, and his first TV weathercasting job was as a weekend weatherman in San Luis Obispo while he was teaching. During his first year of teaching, he was recognized as one of the top 100 new teachers in the country. For 15 years, he taught child development classes at Chico State University. In 2004, he was nominated by students for honorary membership in Phi Eta Sigma, a national honor society, as an outstanding professor. He still occasionally is seen as weathercaster for KHSL-TV in Chico, but most of his time is spent teaching, writing, and visiting schools. He has written over 70 books for children. His National Park Adventure series has received national attention and awards. Mike Graff, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Nancy.
You've woven such an interesting career path for yourself that you started out early with an interest in weather, but you also started out early writing.
I've been writing stories, I think, all the way back since junior high and high school. I would just write them and save them in a journal and call friends and say, I got to read you my latest story. But back then, it was just for fun. It kind of evolved over time to more of a craft for books.
But even then, I think you, when you wrote a story, you wrote a legend about the creation of thunder, lightning, and hail.
That was sixth grade.
In the sixth grade, you're already writing about weather.
A tale of a tale. Well, you know, I grew up in a weather-starved Los Angeles. We didn't have much weather then, although it did snow that one day in third grade. So that was all about what caused, you know, in a legend, rain, thunder, lightning, hail, and tornadoes. They made it all up.
Well, I remember, too, because I grew up in a climate that didn't get snow except when I was in kindergarten. And school let out. We got out to go out and play in the snow because it was a special event. Mm-hmm. And that was when you got interested in weather, when you said, wow, snow.
I think it was that. At least that's what my memory tells me. I had actually had pneumonia for 2 weeks. I was home for 2 weeks. And that was my first day back at school. And it was snowing. It was 11 in the morning. And the third grade teacher took the whole class outside, but then she said, Mike, you have to stay by the window. So I had to watch by the window. So I just watched. I didn't actually go outside.
Well, and then your first book. What was your first book that you wrote?
The first book that I had published was The Weather Report, and that was a teacher's guide to teaching weather. It was picked up by the Weather Channel. I was teaching fourth grade in San Luis Obispo at the time, and the Weather Channel brought me on as an educational consultant and used that book as some of their educational weather services for teachers around the country. And that kind of got me started. It was in the late 1980s. I can admit it's been that long, but it's been that long.
Well, as a weatherman, if you're on TV with the weather, you've got to be interesting. Just like if you're teaching, say, fourth graders, you have to hold their attention. So it must be similar skills that you draw on.
Perhaps. It's 3 minutes or 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and you do definitely want to hold their attention. So some of the verbiage you use or the body language you use, try to draw those viewers in, and hopefully the weather will cooperate and give you something to talk about.
Which in Southern California, I would think, wouldn't be that easy.
Once in a while, it could happen. Now, we'll have some weather to talk about my next time on air here, too. So a little bit going on.
So you taught fourth and fifth graders for like 10 years.
10 years.
And now, though, you have been writing this series of books on the national parks, and you've written 12 of them.
12 of them, yes.
And I imagine, I mean, because when I read it, I feel like you had to have gone to that park. You had to have had those experiences that you are writing about. So that means this has taken you quite a while to visit 12 national parks, learn enough about them to write these stories.
I usually go to the park for about 2 to 3 weeks each summer, and most of the parks are fully accessible in the summer, and that's when all their interpretive events are going on, and I'll attend a lot of those. So I'll go for 2 or 3 weeks. Grand Teton, I was there for a month because some of the snow in the higher elevations made it inaccessible till later in the summer. And I bring a tape recorder, and I'm hiking and backpacking and interviewing people and going to ranger programs, and anytime I get an idea that I think is going to fit in the story, I tape it. Come home usually with about 20 hours of taped ideas. Then I got to sift through all that, put it in order, and then begin the writing process and fact-checking. They're fiction stories, but they need to be accurate to the park experiences. So it takes quite a bit of work doing that.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he has a series of 12 books, Adventures with the Parkers, where this fictional family with two children travel to national parks. And you mentioned one of your newest ones is Grand Teton National Park called To the Top of the Grand. And I noticed, though, if I remember your earlier books you wrote, you have – there's a boy and a girl, and they're twins. So I thought, well, that's convenient because then they're the same age. There's not an older brother or a younger brother. They're the same age. And the young girl was writing in a diary. And I notice now in your later books, they're talking into a tape recorder, just like you said
yeah,
you do.
Yeah. So the diary's kind of morphed and it evolved into that. And then later on, it becomes a journal also, but it's sort of an audio journal. Yeah.
Well, because when the young boy writes it, he doesn't say, dear diary.
Right.
He says he's reporting in his journal. So that's the way you get the story told. You have them first writing it, and now in his later books, they're telling the story. And how did you have the idea to say, oh, I'll make them twins?
You know, I think what I wanted to do was focus on that 8 to 12-year-old age range, and I wanted to have a boy-girl main character. And it was just an early discussion with the publisher of let's just keep them the same age, and that way we can have different activities or different interests that focus together, and rather than having the discrepancy of ages, making a more complex story mm-hmm. that way.
So, but I also noticed that the sketches, the illustrations, are based on real twins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the illustrator had real twins model for these, and definitely used that to make it accurate. And they happened to be the same age as the twins in the book when she did that.
That was convenient. I thought that must have been the case.
Yeah.
So these twins are writing too. Another thing that I liked was at the end of each book, the young boy and the young girl write their impressions, their favorite things, their memories of the park. And I thought, yeah, you need those two different viewpoints. Because I noticed that I identified, even as an adult now, much more with what the young girl wrote. And I thought, that would hardly be fair then. You need a guy's perspective, even though he's a young boy. He liked going to these places where exciting things were happening and there was action. And she would say, oh, I got to see a beaver and I got to see an otter. And I thought, yeah, that's what I like. In fact, I dug out pictures that I had taken on a trip to the Grand Tetons and to Grand Teton National Park and Yellowstone. And I have got picture after picture of a little chipmunk. I really didn't need 10 pictures of a little chipmunk. But that was the kind of thing that I focused on, like she did. And also, at one point, you have the mother saying, okay, let's see if we can find 10 animals today. And I did that same kind of thing. But I wanted to see a bear, yeah. And I never got to see a bear.
Well, you know, Grand Teton is known right now, and there's different surveys online, as the number one national park in the country for seeing wildlife. And when we were there, my wife and I and daughter went last summer, it certainly lived up to that reputation. And where they went out that one evening and said, we're going to see 10, a lot of that comes from actual experiences. My wife and I and daughter and our in-laws were with us. We went. And we went to a place called Oxbow Bend, which in the evening.
Is in the book.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And people come out in hordes. It's for birds. It's beavers, otter. There were elk in the distance, pronghorn as well. So this is a real hot spot for viewing wildlife. We didn't see a grizzly there, but we did get to see a grizzly. And we got to see a very famous bear in the park, Bear 399.
You have that in the book, yeah.
Yeah, Bear 399 is an adult female, and she's had three cubs, and one of her cubs from a previous litter is 6'10", and they tag the bears according to the number they're found. So 399's had three cubs a few years ago. 6'10's one of her daughters from a previous litter, and they actually exchanged cubs a couple years ago in the middle of the night, and this has all been observed. And we got to see Bear 399 also with her three cubs and got some great pictures. And she's a very showy bear, and they know her by the tags in her ears, and she has a scar on her face. She's a very famous bear in the Tetons.
Well, I also thought it was realistic that when the mom says, okay, let's see if we can see 10 animals, and you think, yeah, they're going to actually see 10. But no, they saw 8.
Yes.
And I thought, well, now that's realistic.
That's
a lot.
And that's what happened to us.
I thought
8 was pretty good. You know, we called it a night. It was about 9 o'clock. You know, the Wyoming sunsets are a little later in the middle of summer. And we said, that's enough. But we got close.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he is author of a series of award-winning books for children called Adventures with the Parkers. This is a fictional family with two children, and they visit, in Mike's most recent two books, Grand Teton National Park and Acadia National Park. Now, we've been talking about Grand Teton. There were so many things in that I thought adults would really enjoy reading about. Because you do incorporate, I mean, you are a teacher. I think that's where your heart is, that you're a teacher. And so you incorporate things in your book that educate us. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was how silkworms saved beavers.
Hmm.
Do you remember that in your book, what you wrote about that?
Silkworms saved beavers.
Yeah, because beaver hats were very fashionable. So people were trapping beavers to make these hats. And then when that went out of fashion, people were, oh, silk, let's make things out of silk.
Right. So they didn't need to get the beavers anymore.
They didn't need to kill beavers anymore.
When I go, that came from actually we were on a horseback ride there. And the guides go through interpretive classes. So they're giving us consistent and accurate information. And that was a story that one of the guides spoke about. And the history of the Tetons, it was very much a ranching and hunting area when people came in and started to have different opinions about what they should do with the mountains and the valley there. Let's save it before there isn't anything worth saving. And so it completely transformed the area at the time. But initially, people were coming to hunt beavers and other animals there and then settle and have sort of a dude ranch type of hunting, you know, western, you know, experience there before it became a national park. But I do remember that, yeah.
Then you also gave tips on how to identify trees, techniques for identifying trees. For example, a lodgepole pine. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what
the
you wrote about that?
The lodgepole pine needles will bend into an L shape, two needles. So L for lodgepole pine. Now, the other two were friendly fir and spiky spruce. And my 4-year-old daughter was all about that. Every time we'd come up, and those are the three most predominant trees in the park. There are aspen and some others. But, you know, if you brush your hands through a fir tree, it will be friendly and soft. If you brush your hands through a spruce tree, it will be spiky. And you'll definitely feel those needles poking into you a little bit. So clear identification. If you forget by looking, you touch the needles.
And that's great. Somebody takes your book, they go to the park with their family, and they would probably overlook something like that. I mean, a tree doesn't move like an animal does, so they're probably looking at animals. But here, you've given them tips on how they can get more out of experiencing the plant life, mm-hmm. like identifying these trees. And then you had birds in there. There was a bird, Western Tanager?
Yes. You know, a lot of it comes from our experiences or my experiences when I'm there. And we were on a guided ranger hike around Jackson Lake. And there was just this striking bird with the yellow and orange colors on it. It almost felt like are we in the tropics here? It was just spectacular. So we photographed it extensively, and the ranger leading the hike identified it as a Western Tanager. And it's amazing. It's a beautiful bird. So we had to put that little experience as part of the Parker's story also.
And you mentioned taking photographs, because some of the photographs in your book, there are photographs and illustrations. You have a combination because actually the children are fictional, so those are illustrations drawn by. And I noticed you've had the same illustrator throughout your series.
Yeah, Marjorie Leggett. She's from Colorado, and she's great. You know, she really puts a lot of heart and soul into her pictures and follows the scenery, you know, exceptionally well.
And so that was I really enjoyed the illustrations, but also the photographs, because when you're talking about these things, it really helps to have an actual photograph. And some of them you and your wife took, mm-hmm. or your wife took, and some of you got from other sources.
Yeah, there are a variety of sources. Sometimes my wife and I and our experiences there, and sometimes we'll get some from the Park Service or some photographer cooperatives as well, and the publisher will work through them that way.
For example, you had a picture of two species, right? And I thought, now they would have had to spend a lot of time to find this golden and a black marten, wasn't it?
That was a marmot.
Marmot, yeah.
Yes.
The marmots, the two marmots, both in the same photograph.
Yes. Now the Tetons is unique. I mean, most marmots are a tan or a rusty or a brown color, but they're apparently one of the only places where they will actually have a black color. And we saw several of them. It was actually near the Hidden Falls area, but they're in other parts of the park too. And it's pretty much unique to that area. So I had to put that in the story. And we did get several pictures of them. Marmots are very close to people on some of the trails. They hide in some of the rock crevices nearby, and then they dash between the rocks when they feel threatened. So we saw quite a few of them.
Well, you also saw something called tent caterpillars.
Oh, boy, they're everywhere. they make these little nasty tent things on the bushes, and you look at them, and they're all over the place, and you can see all the activity going on in these little tents. And they're hanging around, 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and you can see little holes in these things, and then you'll see, well, there's one on the trail here, one on the trail there, and they will leave during the day and seek out their food and come back to their tent at night. And then keep repeating that until they, morph into their next stage. So, yeah, they're all over.
So that's something that children can be on watching for?
Actually, if you're in the Tetons in June, you will see them.
Can't miss those.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere.
Well, and I noticed you included a couple of wolves mm-hmm. in your story. And I saw a lot of coyote. when I was in that area, I guess maybe that was Yellowstone, but I didn't get to see wolves. Now, there was also a story about, this I thought was funny, but you must have seen this, a pine marten steals the egg of a ruffed grouse.
You know, I'm always looking for exceptional wildlife observations, especially in a park that is exceptional for wildlife viewing in general. We actually talked to a ranger. There's a part of the park that's called the Rockefeller Preserve, mm-hmm. and it's within the park. The Rockefellers donated this large tract of land to the Tetons. They have their own visitor center, their own trails, and their own rangers, but it's within Grand Teton. So we went on a guided hike there, and it's beautiful. It's up to Phelps Lake, and it's up against the mountains. And the ranger actually told us that story about what he had seen on the exact same trail we were on a few days before him. So I heard that story and said, the Parkers are going to need to see
this.
Yes. We did see a marten do something else later on in the book.
I didn't like that. No, I know it's true, and I thought you were right to include it, but I didn't like reading that part about the little squirrel, because I happen to be partial to squirrels.
Yeah, well, that was right in front of us, and it was in the high country. A marten, you want me to
say
this story?
Now that we've talked about it, we have to tell people.
You know, a marten chased two squirrels to the top of I think it was a spruce tree. We didn't go feel the needles after. And the squirrels usually will jump to another tree, but they were trapped at the top. There wasn't another tree nearby. And the marten bit into one of them and then climbed down the tree and took off and had a meal. And we watched that all right in front of us.
And that actually surprised me, because I think of squirrels as being so fast. And I would think they would, and they can leap from tree to tree. So.
Yeah, it was an isolated tree. I think it, mm-hmm. in the panic of the moment, it had nowhere to go but down, and someone was waiting for it right there.
In fact, I do, now that you mentioned the word panic, one day it looked like a youngster, a squirrel, climbed up a tree and didn't realize, I guess, that I was so close. And when he did, he panicked. And the only time I've ever seen a squirrel fall in an attempt to, because I've seen him make some spectacular jumps, but this little fellow fall to the ground. And I thought, no, but in a little bit he was running up a tree.
Away.
He wasn't hurt. But I hate to hear about little squirrels getting, biting the dust, but it's a realistic thing to include. Mm. And the mother then says, this is the way nature is.
This is nature. The hope that the book is fictitious characters in real life situations. So it's something an average viewer or, you know, a frequent viewer or anybody possibly could see. And those are the activities or experiences I want to cover in the book, is this is what the Tetons and this is what nature and that place is all about.
Yeah, and I felt that as a reader, even though I was an adult and this is aimed for children, I felt I could identify. I could relate to all these things that were happening to them and things that have happened to me that impressed me. Watching animals, I love to watch these little animal dramas. Mm-hmm. That's why I like to go sit by the creek. I never know what little drama will occur, like a little mother raccoon with a little one following along behind. Mm-hmm. That you can just imagine their conversation even when they're going along. Now, earlier you mentioned pronghorn. And I didn't know something interesting about pronghorn. What's the interesting thing that you think about pronghorn?
Well, there's a couple things about pronghorn. I mean, they are, you know, Wyoming alone apparently has a million, you know, and if you drive some of the country roads or back roads of Wyoming, particularly in the evenings, you'll see them everywhere. But the Teton has its own unique herd, and that herd has to go through a migration route every year. And it's the traditional migration route that herd has gone through, because up in the park, it's too cold in the winter and there's not enough food. So they migrate south into lower elevation. But there's been so much development, roads and housing projects, that a lot of that route has been potentially blocked. And so the herd became threatened. And a bunch of organizations, the Park Service included, made a commitment to protect that wildlife migration route, particularly for that pronghorn herd. And so there's about 200 in that herd that will return to the park and leave seasonally. And they're very visible within the park. They're just a little bit separate of a species or a herd than the rest of the ones in Wyoming. They're also North America's fastest land animal. So,
see, that I never thought about, because you see pictures of gazelles in Africa and these animals that are fast. But I didn't know, I guess I never thought about what the fastest land mammal is in, or land animal in North America is.
I've never seen him run that fast, but I've read and know that that's been fact-checked, yes.
And I think it's also important for people to realize what we do when we build these roads, that it's not just something we're doing for our convenience, how it affects these other animals, like you're talking about migration routes. Because often our attitude is, well, these animals are coming up in my backyard. They're intruding on my land, my territory. And I don't think they think about it the other way around. Maybe we're intruding on their territory.
Yeah. And it's about a 200-mile-long migration route, traditional for, you know, the eons that these pronghorn have taken that route. The town around Grand Teton, Jackson, Wyoming, it's almost like you're in the park when you're in that town. And it's a very progressive town. They're very much protecting or into protecting. I can't speak for everybody, but the town wants to protect their natural resources. They're surrounded by it. And it's one of the reasons that's just an exceptional place.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he has written a series of 12 books on the national parks, a fictional family called the Parkers, so he calls it Adventures with the Parkers. His most recent two books are Grand Teton National Park, called To the Top of the Grand, and Acadia National Park, Eye of the Whale. I mentioned that you see, you have your family see beavers and otter, and then there was a what looked like a duck, because you have a photograph of this bird, and you look at it and you think, well, that's a duck. And what, do you remember it?
It was a merganser.
Yes.
Yeah, we were, it's a duck, it's a grebe. Obviously, I'm an amateur birder. but there, that was, again, at Oxbow Bend, and there was a large troop of birders there with, you know, all the technology that you would need. And some of the birds were very close, and some were farther off in the river bend there. That's the Snake River. So my wife and I were, loon, it's got to be a grebe. But the person next to us with the right equipment, and no, that's definitely a merganser. And we took pictures, and he was right.
Well, and describe for people what was distinctive about that, that he didn't quite look like a duck, yet he did look similar to a duck.
It was the colors, I think. It was a black and white and a little bit reddish. And once you look at a merganser, I'm sure there were some bill and beak features that were unique also, but it was really the colors. He was absolutely accurate.
So that was a beautiful bird. You mentioned also that the Tetons, the rocks there, are 2.7 billion years old.
Some of the oldest.
Now, that's the rocks, because you say the mountains themselves, are, as mountains go, are relatively new.
Mountains are relatively new, and one of the reasons you can tell that they're relatively new is they're not eroded. The sharp, jagged peaks. But some of the rocks embedded in the mountains and the formations around there are some of the oldest in North America. Geologically, that's significant.
I just can't wrap my mind around 2.7 billion years.
I can't either.
Well, you have the pictures of, I mentioned the marmots that were the golden, I guess, or the brown one and the black one. There's also a picture that I thought I knew what I was looking at. And in fact, I have almost an identical picture that I took when I was visiting Grand Teton National Park. And when I looked at my picture, I thought I'd taken a picture of a waterfall. Mm. And when I looked in your book, I learned that, oh, that's not quite accurate.
Yeah, Hidden Falls, it's actually probably the most popular place to visit in the park as far as scenery. It's right off of Jenny Lake. And traditionally, a waterfall is a free-flowing cascade of water. And it's called Hidden Falls on their map, and people will always call it Hidden Falls. But it's actually a series of, you know, small cascades throughout. So it doesn't have an extensive free fall to it. So I guess technically it's a cascade, but we call it Hidden Falls, and the park will also. And you take a boat or you can take a trail across Jenny Lake. It's an interpretive tour if you'd like. And then you hike up to Inspiration Point, looking over Jenny Lake and Hidden Falls with the Teton Mountains right behind you. Probably the most scenic spot in the park right there.
In fact, I wondered if I was the only one who didn't know that difference. So I held up our picture to my husband. I said, "What is this a picture of?" And he said, "A waterfall." And I said, "Well, no, I just learned that technically it's not a waterfall because it's not free flowing. It's flowing over rocks."
Yes.
And so that's cascading. I also was interested in those rocky paths that you have, because I tried climbing up some of those rocky paths up. And I didn't make it very far because I chickened out. It got narrow, and it is a very rocky path. So you have pictures in your book of how rocky those paths are.
You mean the trails up into the
trails.
Mountains?
Yeah, the trails. Yeah.
You know, and the Teton, you know, I would say 80 to 90% of the people who visit will stay in the lower elevations and go
like
up.
Me.
But there's good reason. I mean, it's just exceptional, and you always have the views of the mountains, and there's many lakes there. But the backcountry, the Tetons, up into the mountains, and there's canyons between them, is just exceptional. And one of the features in the book is the family does the Teton Crest Trail, which Backpacking Magazine rates it as the number one backpack in all of North America.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that surprised me.
And the trail in many places is actually in really good shape. It's very well traveled. And the neat part about it is you leave the park and you go down to the Teton Village ski area and you take a tram up. with your backpacking equipment. You gain about 4,100 feet of elevation, and you start your hike there. And it's a 39-mile hike point to point if you do the whole thing, mm-hmm. with designated sites along the way and many, many people. And the scenery is just amazing.
So. Well, in the story, they take 5 days. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's pretty good hiking mm-hmm. for the terrain like that, to do that in 5 days, mm-hmm. those 39 miles. Mm-hmm. So I was impressed with that. I also thought it was interesting, and you must have picked this up maybe from one of the interpreters, that the young girl in the story holds up her thumb to tell how close or how far, what distance they should stay from the animals.
Right. You hold your thumb up, and if the animal inside of the animal, and if your thumb covers the animal, you're at a safe distance. If it doesn't, you can still see the animal. You need to back away further whenever mm-hmm. possible. Mm-hmm. And that came from a guidebook at the Jackson Lake Lodge, but the rangers are giving that information out as well. Where we use that in the story was hiking up Cascade Canyon, which is the most popular trail leaving the valley area up toward the mountains. And it was a female moose and her calf. And there was probably about 30 people watching that moose. It was right next to the trail they were. So they probably were just a little too close. But we mm-hmm. were on the trail. So we watched for a little bit, then moved on.
I thought that was such a good way, too, because instead of the parents having saying, don't get too close, what they can do is say, well, hold up your thumb and see if you're far enough away from the animal. And I thought, what a positive way of doing it. And then it's really interesting for them to do that, to have that technique for judging the distance that they should be from
moose
a wild animal.
Are highly unpredictable. You know, we think of bears and we think of wolves, but moose are highly unpredictable.
And they look so benign. They don't look like they're dangerous.
A few days after we did that, I was hiking by myself down a trail and heard some snapping of branches in the bushes, and I turned a corner, and it was a large bull moose, and it was within 15 feet. So ooh. I didn't need to check with my thumb. I knew. I snapped a few pictures and got out of there really fast, but it was, wow, that was close. It was exciting.
But those are big animals.
Very big.
Well, another tip that when they were climbing, and the tip was to keep your nose over your toes.
Yes, and that came from the guides. These are Ex-Im guides. This is mm-hmm. North America's first mountaineering service. So because climbing is such a popular activity, and it's actually near Hidden Falls where they'll take kids climbing, I actually shadowed a family because my characters, Morgan and James in the story, mm-hmm. do climb. So they gave several tips. Keep your nose over your toes for proper balance. Think like a stick man, which means keep yourself upright because that way it'll give you better traction on the rock. And I spent a day climbing and following a family climb to learn the techniques and the lingo so my characters could do that in the story.
Mike, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I want to ask you about your latest book, Adventures with the Parker Series, Secrets of the Sequoias. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Mike is a part-time television weathercaster and a former elementary school teacher and university professor. He has shared his writing and national park experiences with children and teachers in hundreds of schools. Mike has published more than 90 fiction and nonfiction books for children and teachers. He visits many national parks each year, but often comes to Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. He's been going to these parks all his life. His newest book is Secrets of the Sequoias. This is part of the series Adventures with the Parkers. And he has his family of four visit Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Mike Graff, welcome.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Good to be here.
Your books have a similar appearance. You have had the same illustrator for most of the books. This book looks a little different. Your newest book, Secrets of the Sequoias. How is it different?
Well, it's really the same format, the same family. To be honest, it's a new publisher. So the new publisher wanted a different look, and they did use a different illustrator for the first time. They wanted it to be entirely different looking than the others in the series. So we only have one of the Parkers on the cover rather than the whole family. But what is similar to it is the whole family and the adventures in the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. But this one's put out by Far Country Press.
Well, it looks like you have more photographs and not as many illustrations in this new book. Is that the case?
I think so. It's a little more balanced in that way, just a different design, different contacts with the parks. And the publisher wanted a whole fresh look with it, using more photographs rather than illustrations. So, yeah, there will be more photographs in this one than the others.
Well, one of my favorite photographs is of a bear. It's such a wonderful photograph of a bear. And the credit is Kim Graff.
Kimberly Alexander Graff. That's my wife. You know, when we were there, this is just done, my wife and I and my daughter a couple years ago to do the research. The giant forest area in Sequoia Park, between about 6,000, 7,000 feet, it's the largest Sequoia forest in the world that's really accessible, over 2,000 big trees. A whole network of trails in there. And trails for all levels, and there's shuttle buses you can take from one end to the other. But there's some large meadows right in the midst of that forest that are surrounded by these sequoia trees. And when we were there, the day we were there, there were bears in every meadow, and some of them very close to the trail, which, you know, we have to be leery. You're not supposed to be close to bears, but we would turn a corner in the trail, and there they were. So there were several opportunities to take photographs. Most of them were sub-adult, sort of juvenile bears, but I think at one particular point we saw seven bears on one section of the trail. I mean, it was turn a corner and there's another one. And we knew they were coming because people coming the other way would tell us, look out, there's a bear up there.
Well, what you've just described sounds like a section of your book.
Yeah.
And I was reading it thinking, wow, I'll bet Mike and his family had a similar experience.
Absolutely. You know, I walk these trails and look for experiences that'll make a good story, and I carry a tape recorder the whole time. So I'm just jabbering away in my tape recorder. This is going to happen to the Parkers. This happened to us. And we actually read in the news, the Visalia newspaper, which is the town just below Sequoia National Park, that particular year, 2 years ago, there were so many bears in the giant forest. They were looking for more habitat or more things to eat. They were wandering into Three Rivers and some of the foothill towns, some of them just wandering down the streets in those towns. And the theory was is that the drought was forcing them to areas that they weren't used to going to.
Well, since you're busy with your tape recorder, that's probably why your wife has more photo credits than you do in this book.
Yeah, she's the photographer, and I'm taping away. But both Kimberly and my daughter, Maggie, are constantly asking for the tape recorder. I got to type this. What about this? What about this? So we're passing it along. But Kimberly does most of the photos.
Well, you start by listing the top 10 largest trees in the world. Now, notice largest trees, not tallest trees. And why did you do that?
Well, the largest trees in the world are sequoias. The tallest trees in the world are redwoods, both in California. So some redwoods on the north coast of California, Eureka Crescent City up by Redwood National Park and State Park, they'll get up to over 300 feet high. I believe the tallest one is over 370 feet high. Sequoias will get up to close to 300. At a certain point in the sequoia's lifetime, they'll stop growing taller, but they'll continue to grow wider. So if you took the amount of tree or of wood, the volume of the tree, sequoias actually have more wood than a redwood. So they are the largest living things in the world, even though redwoods can grow taller.
Well, since you mentioned that, I was shocked at the root system of a sequoia, because a tree that big, that tall, I expected, wow, those roots must go really deep. Not in your book. It says otherwise.
Spread out far and wide to capture as much water as possible. And that helps the sequoia tree survive. Occasionally, and it happened this year at Calaveras State Park, Sequoia Grove, some of them will topple over in some of the winter storms. Although in Calaveras, that was a tunnel tree. That was a tree that was carved through for the novelty of driving through, so the tree was weakened.
But only a meter to a meter and a half deep, those roots?
Yeah.
That was very surprising to me.
Yeah.
You also have an illustration comparing a sequoia with a 747. And the 747 looks like a dwarf.
I know. I mean, these trees are massive. And I want to mention to you the top 10 trees, two of them very accessible in the park, the General Grant tree in Kings Canyon National Park. And every year, a couple weeks before Christmas, there's the nation's Christmas tree celebration at that tree. So I put a scene about that in the story. And then the General Sherman Tree, which is in the giant forest right in Sequoia National Park, very accessible. In fact, there's a paved trail to it. But one of the easiest little 10, 15-minute walks just to see the two largest trees in the world, both in the park.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he writes a series of books for children, Adventures with the Parkers. His most recent one is Secrets of the Sequoias. And you mentioned this Christmas celebration, which you include in your book. And usually, the end of your book, the two kids are showing, are listing their top 10, their favorites about the park that they visit. And this time there was something that came after that, and this was the Christmas celebration, the epilogue. And I'm assuming you and your family went to that celebration.
Actually, I have been to it years ago. I didn't go recently, but I did get a CD of it and all videotaped and got to interview the people on it. I think the day we were going to go a couple years ago, it was there was some weather issue or something like that. So I had to go in retrospect and use my past experiences and interview people who'd gone recently.
And the photographs were beautiful.
Yeah, that was provided by Sanger Chamber of Commerce, a town near Fresno. They're the ones who sponsor that. They were really supportive in helping me get the right information for that.
In fact, you say in your book that there was a resident of Sanger, a man who's heard this little girl say, made a comment that gave him the idea.
In the 1920s, yeah, this should be the Christmas tree of the nation, and that's where it all started and has continued since then. It's quite a celebration. They take about 5 busloads of people up from the valley, and they bring musicians and speakers and poetry readings. They put a wreath on the tree. Hopefully there's snow around so you get a good Christmas feel, and then they provide a Christmas meal for you after if you want to partake in that.
Well, you also include, I mentioned the photographs of present day, the trees, but you also include in your book pictures. I have to admit, Mike, it made me sad to look at these photographs of the late 1800s.
Yeah, Sequoia's got an amazing history. Many of the parks do. And when you go to Sequoia and you see these trees, and they're incredible, they're massive, and there's nothing like them. So they say there's 75 Sequoia groves left naturally in the wild. 3 of them are in Yosemite. About 15 of them are in Sequoia Kings Canyon. Others are in other areas. But in the late 1800s, people saw these trees and realized there's an amazing amount of wood that you can get from these trees. So the conservation movement hadn't started yet, and whole sections of forests were cut down. There's one that I talk about in the book called Stump Grove. It's right outside the boundary of the park. And literally the whole forested area there is a sea of stumps. And they protected one tree in it, the Boole tree, just to have a token, you know, memory. But that was the time the conservation movement started. People started to see that the trees were worthy of protecting. In 1890, Sequoia became a national park. Because of people cutting the trees down, people saw the need to protect also.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he is telling us about the Sequoias. His most recent book, Adventures with the Parkers, is Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. And the photographs, these old photographs, show these massive trees with the people standing there. You can see the scale then of how huge these trees were. So how can they get trees like that to market? I mean, it's enough of a project just to cut them down. Then what do?
They cut them into sections. In fact, one of the interesting side notes about that is they took some of these trees in the late 1800s. People didn't believe that they were real. So they cut them, and some of them, they just kept the bark, and they shipped them by railroad back east to, you know, world fairs. And even seeing the sections of the trees shipped back east, people called it the California hoax. There's nothing this big that's alive. We don't believe this. But yeah, they have to section it. They have to cut it up.
And not only to believe something like that was alive, but the age of these trees.
The trees will get to about maybe 2,000 to 3,000 years old. Now, that's not the oldest living thing. There is another tree in California and other states in the West that will grow older, the bristlecone pine. And they're very stunted, high-elevation trees. There's some in some of the higher elevations of the eastern Sierra Nevada and on the California-Nevada border and in Nevada and Utah. Bristlecones will get up to 5,000 to 6,000 years old, and you can do dendrochronology, tree ring, you know, sampling to get those ages. Sequoia is up to about 3,000 years old.
Still, that's mind-boggling.
It is
mind-boggling. Any living thing that has been alive 3,000 years on this planet.
There's a museum right in the middle of Sequoia National Park, and one of the things they'll show you in there is a timeline of what, you know, major events have taken place in the world during this particular tree's life. So, I mean, we can imagine some of them.
Well, they're so huge and so old, and yet They start out with something as tiny, you compare it to a flake of oatmeal.
It's the size, I mean, almost looks the same size as a flake of oatmeal. So that's the secrets of the sequoias. You know, they have cones that are about egg shape and egg size. And those cones open up during fire, so fire is beneficial to them. They need fire for the cones to open up. They also need fire because fire will provide some nutrients in the soil, and it'll also open up a section of the forest for them to be able to get some sunlight, and they're going to grow toward the sun. So the secrets of the sequoias are thousands of seeds and thousands of cones dropped into the right area, and a handful of them will survive. And one of the neat things about going to the giant forest, where over 2,000 large trees, over 10 feet in diameter, is defined as a large tree, but there are thousands and thousands of baby sequoias in there. And my daughter, Maggie, when she was there, and other kids, we hear them on the trail, they really take a liking to it. This one is only 2 feet high. This one's 4 feet high. So what's this tree going to be like when I'm 25 or 30? And, you know, so I try to add that little flavor to the story. You know, there's a lot of baby trees, and hopefully they'll keep going.
But so many factors have to come together, because all those seeds, what are the chances of it growing to be an adult tree?
According to the ranger I spoke with, less than one in a million. I mean, much less than one in a million. They have a little wheel of fortune game in the visitor center there. You spin the wheel and you can see all the other possibilities where the wheel will stop for a seed to make it, whether it's drought or fire or a deer foraging on it, or it was laying down in improper soil or whatever it may be. So one in way less than a million.
So many things could go wrong. It's just amazing that any of them survive into adulthood.
Yeah, and I want to mention, too, you know, we're having an abundant rainfall, precipitation, and snowfall year. So the sequoia belt in the Sierras is usually between 5,000 and 7,000 feet. Occasionally, it'll go a little lower. Very, very rarely, it'll go higher. And one of the reasons they're in that particular elevation range is that's where the abundant precipitation and seasonal variations are. So I was in Sequoia last summer backpacking beyond where the sequoia trees are. And this is true all over the Sierra in the West. There were literally thousands of dead trees, like pickup sticks had fallen over. And we ran into trail crew, my friend and I, who were cutting these up to clear the trail. And we asked them what's going on. It was due to climate change and bark infestation by beetles, which is related to climate change. There's this massive tree die-off going on in the Sierras. But I just read an article recently in the San Francisco Chronicle that we're expecting, because this great year with precipitation, first time in over 5 years, that tree issue in the Sierras is really going to be halted for a while or delayed. Things are going to be doing so much better this year because of the precipitation they've gotten.
My guest is Mike Graff, and he writes a series of adventures with the Parkers, a family of four, the two children, twins, that have these adventures in the national parks. And his newest book is Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. And for those of us who live in California, this is kind of a no-brainer. It's not like a trek to Yellowstone or some of these distant parks. It's right here, within driving distance of us.
About a 5 to 6 hour drive. You know, people ask me all the time what my favorite national park is. And, you know, Yellowstone's amazing, and Glacier is incredible, and Grand Canyon and Zion. And I love Yosemite, too. But Sequoia and Kings Canyon is really remarkable. I mean, first, there's a huge amount of backcountry there, so the backpacking is endless. But the accessibility to giant trees just can't be matched. There's several groves that are right next to the road. And because it's two parks in one, there's so much abundant terrain and easy to get to hikes. So, you know, a recommendation is, if you want to see all of it, is go in at Fresno and you go into Kings Canyon and go down to Cedar Grove. There's a great hike to Miss Falls down in Cedar Grove, a beautiful waterfall, all-day hike. And then come back out and take the General's Highway. You know, it goes between General Grant Tree and General Sherman Tree, and you'll come out at Sequoia National Park. And that's where you're in the giant forest. And that's a great culmination to the trip, to spend the time in the giant forest.
Well, something interesting, too, when people go to these places where bears are, we know we have to keep the food out of the bear's reach, which is quite challenging, because I didn't realize how intelligent bears are. They can outsmart us if we don't really follow the proper steps for containing the food. So how do you do that?
Well, the Park Service is, you know, I mean, a little side note on that. I first went to Sequoia probably when I was about 9, 10 years old. And in the giant forest were a series of cabins that you can stay in. And I have vivid memories that night. These were primitive cabins, so there was no bathroom in your cabin. You had to walk to the bathroom. But the bears were all out at night. We saw them right at our doors and windows, and nobody wanted to go anywhere. But the Park Service now, you know, there's proper bear storage facilities throughout the park. So there's bear lockers at any trailhead. You're allowed to keep your food stored properly out of sight in your car during the daytime. But at nighttime, you got to get it out of the car and into proper storage, which is the bear lockers. And they have that at hotels, cabins, campgrounds, and trailheads throughout the park. These bear lockers are bear-proof. They can't get in and out of them.
Because I've seen pictures of what bears can do to an automobile if they're trying to get food out of that car.
And that's not good for the car. It's not good for people. It's not good for the bear. Most times, if a bear gets people food even once, they're addicted to it. So they'll keep coming back, and they'll tag that bear. And when they keep coming back and the bear's tagged, they can monitor its aggressiveness. A lot of times those bears don't stay, you know, alive. They're going to have to put it down at some point because they're going to get aggressive and keep coming back for people food. Protect the bears. Store food properly.
Yeah, and that is a shame because, well, then we hear about bears eating people food, but what do they eat when they don't have access to people food?
They're omnivores. They're opportunists. So they're going to eat worms. They're going to eat grubs. They're going to eat moths, you know, carcasses, berries.
Berries sound okay, but the rest of that, I could see why they might want to check out people food.
Yeah, our marshmallows taste a little better perhaps, but not good for them.
So what are the other steps if the parkers do some other things? For example, they have a container that has to be opened with a screwdriver or something like that because the bears can figure out how to open a container if it's not.
Yeah, they're bear canisters. And if you can, people buy them at REI or some outdoor supplier, but you can also rent them cheaply at any backcountry trailhead in the park. So, for people who eat a lot when they backpack, one bear canister I really stuffs in, and I keep my day's worth of food in the little pouches because I know I'm going to eat it that day. But everything goes in that bear canister at night when you're backpacking. And that includes soap and toothpaste and everything. And they're pretty big, and you can tie them into your backpack or store them in the main container.
Well, in the illustration, it's round, and therefore the kids are told to make sure they put the canister between some rocks so the bear can't roll it off.
Yeah, they'll roll it off and try to break it. And they're, hopefully they're not going to be able to break it, but they can smell it and they know something's in there. So wedge it in. Otherwise, it'll find it somewhere else.
So you've told us then what we humans have to do to outsmart the bears when it comes to food and why it's not good for the people or the bears.
Right.
So we're doing the bears a favor if we contain that food. So bears are something that I've been surprised how often, when I was reading the story, how often they saw bears, because I've been trying all my life to see a bear. I didn't see any bears in Yellowstone, and I'm looking forward to one day maybe I'll get to see a bear in the wild. Is it easier to see bears now than it used to be?
I don't know that answer, but I do have a recommendation. If you want to see a bear, go to Sequoia National Park. Honestly, there's several trailheads. They have a free shuttle bus system. The whole giant forest area is about 40 miles of trails, and you can take the bus from one end and hike back to your car. Every time I have been in the giant forest, literally, I've seen a bear. Last summer, I was doing a backpack with a friend, and our trail ended at the giant forest. We did 60 miles in Sequoia Park, never saw one bear, but the last 4 miles were in the giant forest, and there it was right on the trail. And we've heard people talk about that. We hear people on the trail, there's a bear up there. I think it's the meadows and that concentration of food and habitat that they have in those meadows that are right in the giant forest that draws them there.
Well, let me ask you your opinion then about bringing in grizzlies, because there used to be a lot of grizzlies in California. They were all killed, eliminated from California. What do you think about bringing in grizzlies from other places and repopulating California grizzlies?
Honestly, I don't think I would love to see grizzlies in the state. I think there's going to be too much resistance to that happening. You know, some other animals like wolves are starting to find their own niches, some in California and other areas, and there's a lot of controversy with that. I think at this point, personally, I'd be a little concerned for a grizzly. You know, if they were brought in, or grizzlies if they were brought into, a small area. Ironic that you mentioned grizzlies. My understanding is the last seen or observed wild grizzly in California was seen in the giant forest in Sequoia National Park in the early 1920s. There may have been another one in the Santa Barbara Mountains near the coast. Many of them live near the coast, and that was also the 1920s. But if when I looked it up for the book, you know, grizzly is on the California state flag. It was the early 1920s in the giant forest. The last remaining wild grizzly was seen alive in the state.
Yeah, and you just mentioned that. There he is on our state flag, a big grizzly bear on our state flag, and yet we have no grizzlies.
95 years without him in the state.
Mm. Well, going from these large, huge animals to a little tiny animal that you don't have a photograph, you have an illustration of this little animal called a pika.
Yeah.
And when you first mention in your book, you don't say what a pika is. So we have to read a little farther and say, that's what a pika is. So why are we not familiar with pikas here in California?
Well,
or where we live in Chico, say.
They are high elevation animals. You know, they're a bundle of fur, rabbit family, but smaller, maybe the size of a hamster. Because of their fur, they really need to be at elevations that we're going to provide pretty much year-round cold. So the pika, you know, and they're in other states besides California too, but you'd find them in high mountains, California, Montana, Utah, you know, Wyoming, western states. They're kind of considered the canary in the coal mine for climate change. Because the world is getting warmer and Earth is getting warmer, they're finding less and less suitable habitat. Once it's over 70, 75 degrees for them because of the bundle of fur, they're stressed. And that stress may inhibit their ability to feed and store haystacks for the summer and get out and about. So they have to find shade and not be able to maybe get enough food for them, you know, to forage throughout the year, because they're storing haystacks to eat all year long. And they have them available for them in the winter, but they're getting it all set up for themselves in the summer. So they're moving to higher elevations. And they are still in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park, but if those higher elevations keep getting warmer and warmer, and they can't migrate down because it's too warm for them. So how the pika will do is going to be probably directly related to climate change.
And yet he's so cute. I would love to have a pet pika, but I could see he would be miserable in Chico.
No. Chico summer wouldn't work for him.
You know, speaking of this valley, something that I hadn't thought about, because I think of national parks as being pristine and clean air, and you say, no, wrong. There's pollution in these two parks you're telling us about, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks.
Unfortunately, you know, the whole San Joaquin Valley area, you know, it's a stagnant weather pattern down there. Not a lot of rain, not a lot of precipitation, not a lot of wind, you know, surrounded by mountains. And it's also, you know, a lot of freeways, factory farms, and things going on. So the summer air in particular is pretty bad. And when you're in the park and you're looking west, you can really see it. One of the places to see it, and the parkers note that in their story, is Morro Rock, which is Sierra is known for these great granite domes, and that is one of the best ones. It's totally accessible, maybe a 20, 30-minute walk up, some rails and stairs and all that. And on that granite dome, you can look east and see the high Sierras, and pristine and beautiful. On a July day, looking west into the valley, it really is a sea of air pollution. And how much that pollution is affecting the trees is being highly studied at this point, too.
Well, there's a photograph in your book, too, that I wondered, it's a photo on page 34, that I wondered if I was looking at pollution because the air looks somewhat polluted. I don't know, maybe it was just a hazy sky, but I was wondering if that was the case.
Hazy skies are very common there in the summer, quite a bit.
Well, while we're speaking of things that we wish weren't the case, you tell us that bats suffer from white nose syndrome. And the name of that sounds, white nose, that doesn't sound so bad. But the parkers have to go through disinfectant.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you and your family, did you have to do that when
Absolutely.
You visited a cave?
So one of the neat things about Sequoia Kings Canyon is there are literally, I mean, public is not going to have access to all this. There's literally over 200 caves there.
That surprised me, because I don't think of caves. When I think of these parks, I think of the trees and the outdoors. I don't think of caves. I think of other places where there are caves. But I was surprised, 200 caves in these two parks.
Now, most of those are not accessible to the public. I've been some backcountry areas where I've met up with some spelunkers, and they're gated off. You have to have permission to go in there. One of the caves, though, right in Sequoia Park, Crystal Cave, is highly accessible. It's a trail down to it. Tourists are brought in there, given tours. It's a phenomenally decorated cave. But every visitor who goes in there is required to step on a disinfectant mat to keep that white nose syndrome out of the cave. My understanding is that hasn't happened at least extensively, or maybe not at all, in that particular cave. But that disinfectant is a precaution so that it doesn't, because it is affecting a lot of bats in caves back east.
Well, you mentioned gates, and I love the photograph of this particular gate in the cave that keeps people out and lets bats in.
Right, right. And a big spider web there.
It looks very much like a spider web, except I figured it's made out of iron.
Yeah.
And it's in the shape of a spider web. And so I thought it was a decorative way of separating the people from the bats.
Sure. And they have a nice door that opens up on it, too, so you don't have to crawl through the metal web.
And this is a cave that you say people can go to. This is Crystal Cave.
Very popular tours there. You want to book them ahead of time. They have great interpretive tours in a very, very well-decorated cave. And there's some spelunking things you can do by permission also, so you can get involved with some groups and do a little bit more of a wild caving experience, too.
Well, while we're on the subject of Crystal Cave, and I'm sure this is true, that a worker comes up to the Parkers and his job is to remove lint, a lint remover.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, you see, we saw the volunteers right off the trail there. You know, people just walking, first they ask you not to touch the formations. The oil on our skin will damage their growth. But besides that, the things on our clothes that may get into the air somehow, just by being next to the trail, so you can see the discolored and the damaged formations on the trail or right next to the trail. So people go in there not only looking for garbage, but weighing to get that formation with, you know, little toothbrushes and picks and things like that cleaned up again to get it back to normal.
So volunteers, their job description is to lint pick.
Clean the lint out of the cave.
Lint out of the cave.
Yeah.
I do find that amusing, I have to admit.
And a lot of patience.
Oh, I'll
bet. Very admirable. Spend your day in the darkness.
Well, speaking of dark, the Parkers, and I know I can imagine this, it is so dark in that cave, they put their hand in front of their face and cannot see their hand. It is so dark.
So they would call Crystal Cave a show cave, which means they've wired in, you know, electricity and put in stairs so they can show the cave to the public. So you're going to go in that cave, and highly recommend it. The formations are beautiful and the stories in there, about a half mile walk. But at some point in the cave, the naturalist, the guide, will turn off the lights. And they'll prepare you for that. They'll make sure everybody's seated. And then you can put your hand in front of your face and you won't see anything. And neither will you after 5 minutes. Your eyes don't need to adjust. It's pitch black in there.
Well, I kind of took an informal survey asking people if they knew what the highest mountain in the lower 48, not counting Alaska, is. And people I asked did know that it's Mount Whitney. I don't know if they know it's right there in these parks that you're writing about. People can, and I'm assuming you made it, but that's not for the faint of heart, because that sounds pretty rigorous. So I'm sure people would be, their curiosity would be piqued, whether it's the children or the adults, when they read about Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Thank you so much, Mike. It's been fun talking to you about these parks.
Thank you, Nancy.
My guest has been Mike Graff. He writes Adventures with the Parkers, and his latest is Secrets of the Sequoias. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.